Today on the On Track podcast, we'll look at how the ideas of one man who lived nearly 200 years ago are still affecting us today, and not for the better. Welcome to On Track, where we help Christians to hold to your faith, stay the course, and finish the race. In the 1800s, there lived a man in a small European town. Neither he nor his family were very well known, and there was something peculiar about this man. While he was raised in a nominally Christian home, in his youth he shunned the religion of his family and community and embraced atheism. This decision would have a profound impact on how he lived his life. From an early age, his favorite thing to do was write, particularly poetry, which often contained some dark themes reflecting his worldview of atheism. But writing was all he seemed to want to do. Rather than find work to provide for himself and his wife, he would regularly ask his parents for money. His father tragically passed while the young man was just 20, but instead of helping provide for his mother, he continued to ask her to support him. Even after having multiple children, he would refuse to find steady employment, opting instead to pressure extended family and friends for their resources. He would become close friends with a man we'll call Fred, whose charity he would successfully rely on for years. When Fred's longtime significant other passed away, the man wrote to him a short note of condolence and then asked for more money. Said one person of this man, "His wife and kids lacked money, food, a steady roof over their heads, and even medical attention. They were kicked out of their apartment for refusing to pay the rent." In addition to poorly managing his finances, the man did not practice good hygiene, never exercising, rarely bathing. He was frequently drunk. In his writings, he railed against those with money, complaining of the unfairness of it all, even as his wife pleaded with him to support their family. She said, "If you had only spent more time making capital instead of writing about it, we would have been better off." So miserable was the family that eventually two of the man's daughters would commit suicide. But the one thing he would continue to do was right, determined to share his ideas and fantasies with the world. They were often long, rambling, and hard to follow. And they contained some very disturbing things. They were at times grossly anti-Semitic and racist towards blacks. And maybe unsurprisingly, given the way he lived, they included a radical call to abolish the family altogether. Given all of this, it's hard to imagine many taking this man's ideas seriously. But what if I told you that his ideas have been used by governments around the world since his day? That they inspired generations of activists and opportunistic leaders bent on making his ideas, once thought insane, to be the mainstream? What if I told you that they are the foundation of perhaps the fastest-growing worldview here in the United States today? The man's name we're talking about was Karl Marx. At the funeral of Marx's daughter was one Vladimir Lenin, who would become a Russian despot. It is his name that's most closely mentioned with Marx in the categorization of the worldview dubbed Marxism-Leninism. If you read the writings of communist Russia in the 20th century, they frequently quote Marx. "He was a genius," Lenin said of Marx. "He critically reshaped everything that had been created by human society, without ignoring a single detail." But what were his ideas? If you could sum up what Marx wanted to do, what was it? Fortunately, Marx told us, and his supporters have echoed it over the years. The entire communist program may be summed up in the single sentence, "Abolition of private property," said Marx in the Communist Manifesto. But it wasn't just private property that had to go. So did religion. "Communism begins where atheism begins," he said. In the Communist Manifesto, he and Engels remarked, "Communism abolishes eternal truths. It abolishes all religion and all morality." And this explains a lot about why the proponents of their ideas so badly mistreated their fellow man. By some estimations, communism killed well over 100 million people during the 20th century alone. The founder of Pravda, the Russian Ministry of Propaganda, Nikolai Burkarin, once said, quote, "Religion and communism are incompatible, both theoretically and practically. Communism is incompatible with religious faith." He added, "Religion is the opium of the people," said Karl Marx. It is the task of the Communist Party to make this truth comprehensible to the widest possible circles of the laboring masses. I would encourage you to read from those who escaped communism, like Richard Wurmbrand, or Whitaker Chambers, or Alexander Solzhenitsyn. I recently finished the book Tortured for Christ, The Complete Story of Richard Wurmbrand and his wife Sabina. It is an incredible and discomforting story, but I would encourage you to check that out. It was Solzhenitsyn, a former communist himself, who wrote in his widely read book, The Gulag Archipelago, this: "Within the philosophical system of Marx and Lenin, hatred of God is the principal driving force." And remembering the roots of Marx, the atheism he chose in his youth, you can understand how the proponents of his ideas would pick up that mantle. It was Aristotle who once said, "Men start revolutionary changes for reasons connected with their private lives." You can look at this and shake your head and say, why did anyone of sane and rational mind believe in these ideas, let alone try and govern with them? The answer is as old as time. They were deceived. Instead of being shown the darker, more sinister motivation behind these ideas, people were sold a more noble package of justice. They believed that if they would just tear down the existing societal order and rebuild one in their image, utopia could be achieved. If they could just do away with the natural order, remove the shackles of morality and of responsibility to God, then everyone would be equal and have all of their needs met. No longer would those with the most money oppress the common man. It was fantasy, unbelievably short-sighted, and a denial of human nature. Fast forward to today, and the term Marxism is still not very socially popular. But the ideas have taken on new forms, which are gaining in popularity. Though some of their present-day proponents would deny their beliefs are repackaged Marxism, Marx's ideas are the table upon which modern critical theory is built. Take away the table, and the whole thing falls. Why do I say this? Part of the Marxist table is the idea of what is called the social binary. That just means there are two groups of people in society, the oppressors and the oppressed. The two groups are locked in an ongoing struggle until government totalitarian control is achieved, which will usher in equity for all. With Marx, it was the proletariat and the bourgeoisie, or the common man versus the rich. Today, it's a number of victim groups against each other, victim groups of gender and race and sexual practices and more. As in Marx's day, the oppressed don't necessarily know they are oppressed. So it's necessary that they be made aware of their oppression and how they can fight against it. For Marx and his followers, the process was an awakening to a state of class consciousness. For today's critical theorists, the term is critical consciousness, or, more simply, to be woke. The end goal of the 19th and 20th century Marxist was totalitarian government control, the elimination of private property. Then, and only then, could each man and woman have equally the same. Listen to today's critical theorists, and they'll speak of equity for everyone. Not equality of opportunity, but equality of outcome. One of the chief vehicles for the implementation of Marx's ideas was the elimination of religion. There was to be no God but the state. Today's critical theorists put those who hold to Christianity, especially white male Christians, at the top of their oppressor chain. So how did the ideas of Marx change forms and become the basis of what we're seeing today? You can trace a large portion back to a group of academics from an institution called the Frankfurt School in New York in the 1930s. They came up with some very sick and twisted ideas. The short answer is that they took the sexual deviancy advocated by the likes of Sigmund Freud and married it with the societal revolutionary ideas of Marx. Instead of fighting an economic class war, they would fight a culture war, one that sought to tear down societal norms and cultural morality. Paul Kingor is a professor and author of the book The Devil and Karl Marx. He wrote of them a passage I'll quote at length here. "One can look at the Frankfurt School's cultural Marxism not as a replacement for classical Marxism, but as the accelerator pedal for a wheezing, stalling vehicle. The cultural Marxist fully agrees with the classical Marxist that history passes through a series of stages on the way to the final Marxist utopia, through feudalism and capitalism and socialism, and ultimately to the classless society. But the cultural Marxist recognizes that communists will not get there by economics alone. Cultural Marxists understand that the revolution requires a culture war over an economic war. The West had rejected Marxism, and these men knew it would be useless to try and bring the revolution they desired through the economic class war that Marx championed. Instead, they needed to bring it through a cultural conflict. Now, to be clear, there are certainly differences between critical theory and Marxism, and you can argue whether they are the same thing or essentially the same. But regardless of how you label it, the undergirding table of Marx still stands, without which there could be no modern critical theory. What exactly makes up what we call critical theory? Well, that is something that will take another podcast to unpack. But suffice it to say, it's a collection of theories and worldviews bound together by a common goal, the tearing down of Western civilization. I'll wrap up with this quote. Alexander Trachtenberg was identified by Whitaker Chambers as the head of the GPU in the United States. The GPU is the Soviet military police. One former communist wrote in her memoir, "Trachtenberg once said to me that when communism came to America, it would come under the label of progressive democracy. It will come in labels acceptable to the American people." She went on to quote Trachtenberg from a conversation in New York in 1944. Quote, "When we get ready to take the United States, we will not take it under the label of communism. We will not take it under the label of socialism. These labels are unpleasant to the American people and have been speared too much. We will take the United States under labels we have made very lovable. We will take it under liberalism, under progressivism, under democracy. But take it, we will." End quote. The ideas of Karl Marx are still alive and well today. But much like Marx and his early supporters, its proponents would prefer you not know the whole story. For Christian believers, what is the antidote to these destructive ideas? I would say the answer is the Word of God. And I encourage you to know the Scriptures and to believe them. Have a biblical worldview that is anchored in truth, so that you can more easily spot deception. Humanity changes, but human nature does not, and reality does not. And once you realize there's nothing new under the sun, as Ecclesiastes says, you understand that there are really no new ideas. They come and go, are recycled and repackaged. But God's Word is true and trustworthy. You can count on it from age to age. Thanks for listening to On Track. For more, visit our website at keeponTrack.org.